Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find a little bit disturbing.
If you're still listening, tell a friend about the podcast. No, come on, text them. Tell them you like Slaughter. Tell them, come out to them. Tell them about true crime.
Do you think that's what people do? Do you think we're one of those podcasts that people put on to fall asleep to?
Possibly. Although every now and then we sort of like bark like a dog or scream, so...
That is why I pepper in a little...
Oh my god!
Every 2 minutes. Listen to me! Yeah. Give me attention! So, I'm going to kick us off with a tale pretty well known.
Yeah?
The Acid Bath Murderer.
Good one.
Yeah, a little disappointing though. At no point is there a bath.
Or any acid.
There is acid, but like I was
There's
having...
no bath?
No. Like no, I was having...
I thought it was like
a bath.
Breaking
yeah.
Bad.
Yeah, no, me too. I thought it was going to be really glamorous. He was like, oh, just settle down. Let me use some of my own bubble bath concoction. No, it's bullshit.
Oh, I didn't think they were alive when he put them in. I thought it was like to dispose.
Yeah, it is to dispose. I'm just saying it's a bath. There's no bath.
It's a bloody bath.
Anyway, so I'm going to begin my story with a lady. We're going to begin at the end.
Okay.
Because that's how I like to do things. I'm going to begin midway through.
You fucking rebel.
With our lady. And she was called Olive, Henrietta, Helen, Olivia, Robarts, Durand Deacon.
Oh my good God.
One woman, that's her entire name.
Why?
And the names are really similar too. She's called Olive and Olivia, Henrietta and Helen. Well, it's like if they just called me Emma, Emily, Elizabeth, Emmeline. They just give me all the same names several times.
Yeah.
I mean, I was looking, after I read that, I was like, oh, I'm going to look up what the most popular baby names are of 2016 and, you know,
was it Strawberry?
See what weird things they've come up with. In the top 10 were both Olivia and Emma. Like, it was super disappointing. I was like,
You're so generic.
I was like, I thought we lived in the future now. Like, we can actually do a video call. Do you remember, like, Romeo and Michelle when they're like, in the future, we'll video call. Like, we can do that now. It happens. But yet no one's naming their child Zorg.
No.
I hope I live to see the day. So, Olive, Henrietta, Helen, Olivia, Deacon, Durard Deacon. Mrs. Durard Deacon.
Say that three times fast.
Nope. She lived in a hotel for 6 years after her husband died.
Oh, I'd love to live in a hotel.
Isn't that amazing? Like, it's so much better than just an old people's home. Like, everything's cleaned for you and, like, meals are cooked for you, but yeah, it's glamorous.
Yeah. Or it'd probably be really irritating after a while.
I mean, it depends what hotel as well. Like, Damned to an Eternity in the Travel Lodge isn't quite as appealing.
Alan Partridge style.
Yeah,
that's not glamorous or cool.
But this was the Onslow Court Hotel, which is in Kensington, so it's now something slightly different. And it would cost them, like, because I was thinking, surely to live in a hotel, that's mental. It would cost £5.05 a week to live there.
Was that a lot then?
Well, it was actually about £119 to live there per week. Which, to say you're living in Kensington and you've got a cleaner, that's pretty fucking reasonable. So she'd lived there for 6 years. And for over 4 years, she'd had a casual acquaintance with a man who lived there. I mean, there was a few people that lived in a hotel. It was like a thing to do. She was 69, and this man, he was very neat. He had a little nice clipped moustache. Like, I wouldn't
You're not
fuck him.
Like my guy.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't fuck him, but I'd introduce him to my friends.
You'd set him up with people.
Yeah. It was odd that he lived there because he was only 39 years old. So the people that
with her, separately.
Yeah, he was a casual acquaintance. I'm not just bedding a casual acquaintance in this hotel. And this was he was sorry. It was odd that he was young because, like I say, a lot of it would be older people that would live in the hotels. You'd usually have a family and live in a house, of course. And this was taking place about 6 months before the end of World War II. So we're in 1944.
Right.
So, obviously, a young man at this time should have been or would have been expected to be off fighting. So, his presence there was quite bizarre. Mm. It turned out that he was an engineer and he claimed that he was working on inventions and creating patents for things that would help with the war effort. So, these two people developed a friendship and they would, like, have a drink together, just hanging out, relaxing, maxing all cool.
Shooting some meatballs outside of the school.
Shooting some billiards down in the parlour. So at this time, he wasn't particularly suspicious other than he was so much younger, but it would later come out that at this time that he was becoming friends with Mr. Andikin, he'd already murdered 5 people.
Oh, shit.
And this guy was John George Haig. So... the story really kicks off, so Valentine's Day in 1949, so it's the 4 years he'd lived there. Mrs. Durandeacon, she was having lunch with a friend in the hotel, as you do, and she was showing her latest invention.
Yeah.
Everyone's a creative at this point. So she pulls out a box full of plastic fingernails.
Oh, God. I've invented something!
Which... actually, it's quite great now, but a little bit terrifying. If that's the first time you've seen a fake fingernail.
Like, so she invented false fingernails? Like,
she was trying to, yeah.
Stick-ons.
Yeah, and like she used to... So she had plastic ones in this box, but she'd also had like paper ones that she'd cut out and glued to her own hands.
Not paper ones! She's not washing up with them on.
Well, she's not in the hotel, no. Experimenting. I mean, I like it. But so she went over to him, because he was into patents and things, and asked if he thought her idea was worth anything. Like, will people go for these plastic fingernails I'm carrying around?
In a box.
And he said, well, I'll have a think about it and let you know.
It's not really my line of expertise, but...
yeah. But this gave him an idea of a very different nature. So Haig, at this point, was in debt. Although he claimed to be an engineer working for this inventions company, he had no regular income. He was in a losing streak on gambling. He was overdrawn and he was behind on his hotel bill. He owed them £50. Which was about £1,100 that he owed the hotel. I mean, that's because they're classy. They won't just kick people out. They'll be like, oh, he's a gentleman. We'll give him a chance.
Yeah, to be fair, they were pretty good about stuff like that, weren't they? Now it's like, getting paid, see you later.
Yeah, fuck off.
Particularly in London. Good day.
So the next day, he started to put his plan into action. He drove to a workshop that he had in Crawley in Sussex. And this workshop actually belonged to his old employers, and he now just borrowed it off them because they didn't use it anymore, which I think is like very risky. If you're going to use an employer's workshop to do evil things, like almost like editing a not suitable for work podcast on a borrowed laptop. Hopefully, if you subscribe to the Patreon, this won't need to happen any longer. So he went down to the workshop, and one of his business acquaintances that was like milling around this industrial area place, Mr. Davis, he asked him if he could go and collect some acid from London. Well, it just come from there, but sent someone back and went to his old boss that he was borrowing the workshop off and said, can I borrow some money that I'm going to give you back later? So he obviously had plans for this money because he couldn't afford to pay it back yet. So... Davis, that he had asked to go about, he was the one who then started, he went into the workshop and had to top up these carboys, topped up the old ones and took an empty one away so we could fill it up and bring it back. I'm sorry, 10 gallons of sulfuric acid was in a carboy. But it's pretty much a waste of time. Like, if he wants somebody else to be doing the dirty work, John Haig had purchased the sulfuric acid in his name and Davis was just picking it up. So the paper trail still leads straight back to him. He wasn't really trying to cover his tracks.
Right.
He just couldn't be asked to do heavy lifting, it seems like. So on Thursday, Haig then bought a 45-gallon drum that was prepared so that it would resist the corrosive acid and, like, wouldn't resolve. So obviously he's going to be shoving some in there.
Right.
And he told Mrs. Duran Deacon that fingernails are go.
It's a goer.
We're going to do it. Pop on down to my Crawley workshop on Friday and we'll see what we can do about these things. So on the Friday, 2:30, they left the hotel together, met downstairs and then drove off to Crawley in his car. On the back seat, he had a hat box, mm-hmm. which cleverly disguised and contained a .38 Enfield revolver and eight rounds of ammo. Like you often see that in like the old timey films where they hide a Tommy gun in a hat box or something.
Yeah.
Like what's the modern equivalent of a hat box?
Because people wore a lot of hats then.
But what do you do now if you're like, oh, I want to carry a gun around without people knowing? What are we hiding it in?
People carry those massive handbags.
Just in a bag. Like, it's not really very creative. But I'm just going to carry it in a bag. Done. Okay. So then about 4:30, they were in the workshop. He obviously lured her in to have a look, said, come see these plans. And then while she was facing a workbench, he came behind and shot her in the back of the head. And Haig just fully explains this in detail to the police. It's mainly his information that we have to go off because Mrs. Duran Deacon was slightly dead at the time.
I like Mrs. Duran Deacon.
She's very rich. She's like,
I'd painted her in my mind.
Like a friend. She was like sort of.
She wore a lot of floral jackets in my head. Or like those sort of like, do you know when your skirt matches your little jacket?
Yeah, like, I'm thinking more of like the plump, the Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey. She's a bit of a Maggie Smith, I think.
Do you think? Oh, I didn't think she'd be that posh living in the hotel.
Oh yeah, crazy rich to live in a hotel.
Yeah, I guess.
Doesn't matter because he chopped her into bits, mashed her right up, and shoved her in a barrel. You knew it was coming. You're in a true crime podcast.
I'm in a true crime podcast.
Mashed her in the barrel. But he just left her there for a bit, went off, go and spoke to his old boss, say, oh, the old lady never came, so I haven't got your money.
Oh.
Obviously trying to, like, give himself a bit of an alibi.
Yeah.
Went out for dinner, went and had some tea and poached eggs on toast.
As you do.
And then came back and started pumping the acid into the barrel. And then went home. He was back in the hotel about 11 p.m.
So did he have a moment? Days work. He just wanted...
He was in debt. He wanted her money. Yes. So that morning, he went about the hotel playing innocent and sowing some seeds of doubt, like speaking to people in the dining hall, being like, oh, have you seen Mrs. Duran Deacon this morning? I can't think where she was. She was supposed to meet me yesterday. I never saw her. Just sort of playing innocent.
Like when you're going to be off sick the next day, you're like, oh, I'm not feeling very well today. Well, I feel a little bit ill today. I've got a sore throat.
Got to sow those seeds.
Yeah.
So he spoke to another acquaintance, another lady, and she was like, yeah, I'm really worried about her. Let's go check the room. Obviously, it hadn't been slept in. But they didn't call the police because she was a rich older lady. She could gad about if she wanted to. She could go away if she liked. And so that day, Haig then returned to Crawley to check on the body because it didn't just dissolve straight away, pump a bit more acid in. On the way, he sold her watch in Horsham, pumped in the acid, and on the way back sold her Persian lamb coat for £50. So he's already trying to like make little bits of her. The next day, we're now on Sunday of this week, he then went to the same woman that he checked the room with, this friend, who was still getting quite suspicious, and he was like, right, if I'm gonna hide it, I'm gonna have to be in on it. Like, I'm gonna have to help the police, otherwise it looks like I'm, you know, involved. So he says to her, shall we go to the police together and report this, and tries to act like he's been really helpful in the investigation.
Yeah.
So they were both interviewed by a policewoman called Sergeant Lamborn, who just basically, and like in loads of different books and articles I read, it was like she just had a gut instinct about John Hague. Like, he was giving her all the right words, but she looked at him and was like, nope.
Yeah.
There is something odd about you. I know a creep when I see one.
Yeah. It's weird how you do, don't you? You just think, that guy's fucking creepy.
Google was well sexist about this issue. She's called Alexandra. So I was like typing in, oh, Alexandra Lambourne. And it was like, oh, did you mean Alexander? And I'm like, no, I fucking didn't. No. There is no Sergeant Alexander Lambourne who had gut instincts about murders. Piss off, Google. Then a call was put through to Scotland Yard's record office to do a background check on him. And it revealed that he'd actually been in prison 3 times for crimes that had been connected with fraudulently obtaining money.
Right.
So he already had form, not murdering anyone, but he was, his main job was defrauding people, pretty much. During this time, after they'd been to the police station, Hague was on his way back to Crawley, check on the body, pump in some more acid, keep on top of things. Basically, once it sort of, in my head, it was like just dissolves, like fizzes away.
Oh no, it wouldn't though, would it? It'd be all clumpy.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit more like that episode from Break, like it sort of creates like a sludge.
Yeah.
And I actually watched, there was a thing on YouTube where they were showing, demonstrating how it would happen with like a chicken thigh in sulfuric acid. It's not even quick. Like, it would take half an hour for this chicken thigh to still just be a little bit sloppy.
Yeah.
So to dissolve a body, I mean, we're only like 2 days down.
It's like in a cartoon, it'd be like 2 seconds. In real life, it'd be like,
no, she's fizzing away.
Long time.
Like, still at it. Having to stir it, pump it in. So over the next couple of days, the investigation's continuing and he's just not really laying low. He's just continuing to sell off a jewellery and like tip out the sludge in the yard just outside the workshop.
There's a lot of witnesses seeing him pawning shit or selling shit.
Yeah.
Like he's, it's
like he's
not
literally
clever.
Driving from London to Sussex and on the way just going to shops and selling things off. Like, he's not trying to be smart about
some
it.
People get caught.
Well, it's his, in his head, he was like, if there's no body, they can't convict me of murder. Like, that was his belief, was that's the law, which is wrong. It's if there's no body of evidence, you can convict them. But he was convinced that as long as they don't find her, she'll just always be a missing person. They can't
actually get me. Yeah, he just thought it would just never come to.
So he wasn't scared. And as we know, or I'll go into it, he'd done this before and hadn't been caught. He pretty much thought he was invincible at this point.
Mm.
She had a plastic handbag because obviously in 1949 plastic was like the most desirable, which was only very slightly damaged. So he just was like, oh, shove it behind some bricks at the scene of the crime. No need to do much more than that. And he went to his boss, who he'd borrowed the money off, to pay him back, which at which point Mr. Jones, the boss, said, the police have been here to speak to me about you.
Oh.
And Hague was like, oh, I'm not doing anything. I'm not in any trouble.
I'm not murdered anyone.
But if I am in trouble, stay away from the workshop. How can you
That's terrible.
How you make it like, well, if I am convicted, just don't look in this room.
There's definitely nothing in the workshop that you would want to see. That's like when you're trying to tell someone else's secret, but you can't because you promised you'd keep quiet. Well, they're definitely not pregnant with so-and-so's child.
So, Saturday the 26th of February, so about 12 days after, I know, sorry, about a week after the murder, this boss, Jones, took the police straight to the Giles Yard workshop and, with his key, got in. In there, they found the pump, a rubber apron, rubber gloves, a gas mask, and the hat box containing the gun. And the receipt for her Persian lamb coat.
Oh, shit. So, everything.
So, Sunday, they chilled out. And
it's a Sabbath day, so.
We're not doing shit on Sunday. Like, we know it's you, but roast potatoes are on.
Yeah.
So, Monday, they went
to... Maybe it's a Monday.
They went and took John Hague into Chelsea Police Station for questioning. And he initially said he didn't do it, but when they presented him with the receipt for the coat, he just admitted it. Said, yeah, I've been selling off all of her belongings, but it was just, he said it was like a tale of blackmail. He's like, I've got a long story to tell you. It's about blackmail. I definitely didn't do a killing. That's it. So the lead investigators, Symes and Barrett, left the room to be like, okay, he's about to make a confession. We'll just go and sort some things.
Just go get some drinks down the pub.
While they were out the room, Haig spoke to D.I. Webb, the officer that was left to watch him, and just said, oh, what are the chances of someone escaping from Broadmoor?
Yeah!
Like, so...
subtle.
Already... he's hoping... well, Broadmoor is... what was Broadmoor Institute for the Criminally Insane. So, it's a psychiatric institution.
Some really good documentaries on Broadmoor.
So, already, he's thinking, I'm going to plead insanity on this one. And not only... and escape from it. So... which leads to a lot of things, because John Haig had mentioned in his confession later that he drank the blood of his victims, and that has been widely discredited. I mean, he maintained it the whole time, but people have never really taken it seriously. Of course, you can see newspaper articles of the vampire killer.
Yeah.
But he's remembered as the acid bath murderer because it's definitely believed that he just made that up so that he could be seen as insane.
Right.
And the fact that he was saying to escape from Broadmoor suggests that he's thinking, I'll pretend and then get out.
Yeah.
The inspector obviously said, I'm not going to talk to you about that. And Haig responded with, well, if I told you the truth, you wouldn't believe me. It just sounds too fantastic for belief. I think the choice of words pretty important there. I know he means fantastic as in, like, fantastical, like fantasy, but still, he has this idea that he is above the law and that he's pretty invincible. So even in his confession, he still felt there was a chance that he would go free. He kept telling them, well, no trace is going to be found of her, and her body's never coming back, and things like this, just sort of taunting them. And while he was telling the story of how he killed Mrs. Duran Deacon, he just would, like, briefly mention other murders, saying, like, oh, well, there were other people, but that's the subject of another story.
They fucking tell us now.
Yeah, and the police were pretty much like, I think you kind of have to. So eventually he gave them the names of William McSwan, McSwan's parents, so Mr. and Mrs., and Dr. and Mrs. Henderson, who had all been disposed of in a very similar manner. So
that's a lot of acid.
That is a fuckload of acid, right?
Yeah, what is that, five people?
Five people all disposed of in acid. So,
and they must have been at similar times if it's like three of one family as well.
Mm. Well, so we'll get. So I'll get onto that story now. So he met and rekindled a friendship acquaintance with William McSwan in 1944. He became a friend of the family and would go and visit McSwan's parents with him. And there was this weird story where he's claimed that he was going to fix a pinball machine for William. And had it in his basement. So he said, oh, come down to the basement and have a look at it, see what you think. And while he was down there, smacked him on the back of the head, claimed he drank his blood.
Yeah.
And shoved him in a water butt, which he then filled with acid.
Oh, God.
And then just tipped him down the drain. He stopped anyone arousing suspicion, because obviously in 1944, men would either be conscripted... or be trying to escape conscription.
Yeah.
So he told McSwan's parents that he was in hiding to avoid being called up to fight.
Right.
That he'd gone away.
Which is sort of... wasn't that shameful, though, as well? It's like...
pretty much. So
not
I
only
don't...
is he slandering him, but he's murdered him. It's like...
yeah, so they wouldn't have wanted to tell people. The parents would have kept up the pretense, because they wouldn't have wanted to admit, oh, he's running away from his duty.
Yeah.
And he would, like, forge letters to the parents saying, oh, I'm in Scotland, or I'm here. And then realised, actually, now that William's gone, he would have been the heir to their business and their house and things like that. So I'm going to bump them off too. Kept it going a year and then killed both his parents in the acid drum. No bath, just a drum.
Should have been called the acid drum murderer, really.
I know! And unless that's some kind of weird dance genre of music. I'm really into acid drum. And so then he could assume the identity of William, obviously having all of his belongings, because he did the murder.
Yeah.
Took control of all their assets. And was able to, he got a few £1,000 out of it and was able to live for quite a few years that way.
That would have been a lot then, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, he lived for, that was his livelihood for a while. But he did get through it.
Was he, like, gambling and...
Just, like, not living a normal life, living in a hotel, like, buying fancy cars. Yeah. Like, easy come, easy go. If you didn't have to work for it, don't really give a shit about being careful with it.
Whereas, like, I remember when one of my first job when I was getting paid hourly and I was like, this coffee is 1 hour's work, and I just tot everything up by how many hours it takes to pay for it. It's so depressing.
So you wouldn't go and buy a fancy coffee, would you?
No.
So you needed some more victims. So he met Dr. and Mrs. Henderson at a hotel that they were all living in. Everyone's just living in a hotel in Brighton. Took them to the Crawley workshop on some various pretense, shot them in the head, apparently drank their blood, and made them all melty.
Oh, God.
He also then forged letters to their family, to her brother, saying that they'd gone to emigrate to Australia. Again, rich people living in a hotel, something that could have happened. And it's hard to check up, like, communication. Although we're in, like, the late 40s, you can telephone people.
Could just text them, could you?
Not long or distance. Email.
Could you find my iPhone?
1st of March, Haig's now in custody, and the police go to the scene of the crime to try and collect some evidence for it. So, despite Haig's complete confidence that they're going to find nothing, you've got nothing on me, 4 wooden boxes of sludge and crap were collected so that some poor sod had to sift through it.
I guess there was no DNA then.
No, not really. But they were able to find 28 pounds of fat.
That's a plastic fingernail.
3 gallstones. A part of a foot.
Oh, no.
18 corroded bone fragments. A lipstick container.
I love how the bones barely made it, but the lipstick container is fucking indestructible.
A full, complete set of dentures.
Oh my god.
Which were identified as being Mrs. Duran Deacon's dentures.
Shit.
And the handle of her
indestructible
handbag. Well, I just think when he was pouring out the sludge, surely he could see that there's a full set of gnashers there.
Part of a foot.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how big. The fact that they knew it was part of a foot tells me it was quite sizable.
Yeah.
Because it just. Ugh. Just look round. I don't think he was looking too closely. I mean, again, similar to last week's Dennis Nielsen, I don't think he didn't love the murder. He was motivated by money. He was trying to commit the perfect crime where he could defraud people and there would be no witness. There was an interview with a guy that had been in prison, and he was saying that the weakest link in any case is the victim. And Haig was obviously trying to make sure that he was eliminating the weak link. So he wasn't loving murder. He was just felt like this is the way to commit crime.
Shooting people in the head, there's no like pleasure in that, is
there? Back of the head. He wasn't looking at them.
Yeah.
So I think when he was tipping away the sludge, he wasn't really paying attention to the contents and was more just fucking get out.
Yeah.
So 2 days after he was held in prison, Haig then admitted to 3 other murders of strangers that he'd murdered and robbed and then disposed of in acid after drinking their blood. But there was no evidence to support this. And
what, the blood drinking?
The blood drinking, all these other 3 murders.
Why was he admitting to them then?
At this point, they think he was just trying to really consolidate the fact that he was insane. Like, he was in prison, and his main defence now was that they've got to believe I'm insane so that I can be sent to Broadmoor. I'm not going to be hanged. So he was just saying, oh, and I killed this person and drank their blood. Oh, and I killed this person and drank their blood. They definitely believed the blood drinking was fabricated. And part of the reason they said this was because, if you remember earlier, the poached eggs on toast that he said he went off and had before pouring the acid in. Apparently, blood is an emetic, so if he drank a pint of blood the way that he claimed he would have done after eating, he would definitely have just been vomiting absolutely everywhere. Like, there's no way he could have done it.
I love little details like that.
I was quite surprised by that, because I'd watched a documentary on real-life vampires.
You can't have eggs and blood.
Yeah, we should do an episode on them.
No, eggs and blood!
And,
I love the real life.
So they were just drinking, but they weren't drinking like pints of blood. They're just like, oh, we scratch ourselves so we bleed a bit and then I lick it.
Yeah, was it those teenagers? I think I've seen that. And they got like special fangs made and they were super into it.
But they were just like licking a tiny bit of blood. Yeah. Like if you cut your finger and you're like, oh, just suck it, it'll be fine.
We did that Brisbane woman as well, didn't we? Who was like a
lesbian
vampire killer apparently.
So as well, he's trying to come up with other things to prove he's mental. So he claimed that, oh, well, I drink blood and I drink my own urine. I have done since I was a boy. Ugh. Which then he was like, I'm going to show you. And like every time the prison doctor was around, he'd be like, look, I drink my own urine. Which I think is like...
Did he have a cup or is he just trying to piss up in his mouth?
I don't know. Either one's good. If he could piss up in his own mouth...
I'd watch either.
If he could piss up in his own mouth, I don't think he'd be in this situation now because that is a skill you can take right to the bank.
Yeah.
But I think as well, it's like the most harmless, weird thing that you can demonstrate. Like, it's not like, oh, I'm like...
Yeah, don't lock people up for that. There's people who do that for supposed health
reasons.
But he's
got to prove that he's insane, so he can prove that he can drink his own piss, like, just about, I can hold my nose and gag it down. But I can't do an Albert Fish and be like, yeah, I shove nails in my taint and, like, just jam them up, because you're not going to go through with it, surely. So part of... He also then tried to build his case further, and he said that this insanity went back to his childhood. He'd grown up in Yorkshire to parents who were both members of a religious sect called the Plymouth Brethren. Basically, they were sort of like very austere, like Quaker-esque, like they weren't allowed to do anything. Like, you're not allowed to play sports, you're not allowed to dance unless it's like in worship. Like,
yeah, a bit like a...
Really stark. I mean, he said he had a happy childhood, but then he said that they sent him to school. He had a music scholarship because he played the piano. They sent him to this Catholic school, and he claimed that the lavish Catholicism compared with, like, the harsh Plymouth Brethren meant that he had a conflict in his mind. And obviously all the doctors were like, at 10, I don't think you were really aware of the nuances and the doctrines.
Yeah, like having an existential crisis at 10.
Yeah, enough to send
you're more
you
bothered
mad.
About what jammers you're wearing that night.
So he told them more about his life. He had married and left the Brethren. He'd actually split up with his wife. They'd had a child and she'd given it for adoption. So he's basically shunned from there. And he just decided that he needed to make his own way in the world without them. He'd been really sheltered by this religious sect, and now he was out there with not much life skills in that sense. Like, when you come from such a closed community, it can de-skill you in that you don't know how to live without them, which is part of how a cult can keep people there. That's one of the things they do, is they make it so that you can't survive without them and you don't know how to cope in the real world.
Yeah, I was listening to the Children of God by Last Podcast on the Left recently, and it was saying, like, because they'd given over all their money and stuff.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
They didn't have anything to leave the cult with.
Yeah, like, you can't do it.
All their money was just tied up in that cult.
So he devised a method of swindling a hire purchase company by, he'd forge a document for a car that didn't exist and give it a fake owner that didn't exist and collect the money for it. But he was found, and this is his first stint in prison. He went for 15 months. And at this point, he was quoted as saying, "When I first discovered there were easier ways to make a living than working long hours in an office, I didn't ask myself if it was right or wrong. That seemed to me to be irrelevant." So he was like, well, fuck it.
Don't give a shit.
I can do it. I think he sort of went, yeah. I did that bit. So then when he came out of prison, he spent 4 years on his next fraud. He would sell shares for companies that didn't exist.
Yeah.
And then just move town before people could catch him out. And he went to prison again. He was then released in 1940. So it's wartime. And he became a fire watcher in the Blitz. But was back in prison within a year of doing that for selling household goods.
What's a fire watcher?
So you'd be, when it was the air raid, you'd be one of the people that was on top.
Right.
And you'd be going and looking and trying to put out fire, small fires that you could see. So he wouldn't be allowed down in the shelters. He'd be out on top. So basically, if a house did get bombed, well, all the houses are empty. Yeah. You've pretty much got free rein to go looting. Yeah. Everyone's locked up in their bunkers. And he was just nicking stuff and selling it.
Yeah.
Like, it's, for an opportunistic criminal, it's the Brilliant. Worst job you can give them.
Yeah.
And so then he said that he was very affected by what he saw in the Blitz, which could be true. I mean, it was a horrendous thing if you're just watching things be bombed to shit in front of you. And began to doubt God. And so at this point, he also began experimenting. He knew that he needed the perfect crime. He was fed up of going back to prison, fucked off with it. He was thinking there must be a way out. So he, part of his job in the prison, he had access to acid.
Yeah.
And he would fill cans with acid that were stolen, and he would get other prisoners to bring him like dead mice or dead baby birds and practice dissolving them in acid and working out how long it took them to dissolve. Mm. And think, right, if a mouse is 1/30th of a human body, and like, how much will it take from it, and just being a spod about it.
I mean, I guess he had time.
Yeah, and basically, like, some people, like, for someone who's brought up really strict Christian childhood, as I can identify with, once you decide that there's no God, it can pretty much go one of two ways. Like, for me, thinking that makes you realise, right, it's all about humanism, and if there is no afterlife and there is no God, then we have to be as good as we can be now because there's nothing else afterwards.
Yeah,
like we have to look after each other as best we can because this is all we've got.
Like, you don't need that threat of punishment from a higher being. It's like, this is enough.
Whereas he went the other way and was like,
there's no punishment.
Yeah, if there's no God, and the Plymouth Brethren were all very fire and brimstone, like, do this because that's sinful, and very much on the downer on things. So once he realised he wasn't going to be struck down dead because he'd done something, he was like, right, fuck it, I can kill anyone I want. So when he got out of prison, fresh with his idea for the aciding, was then March 1944 when he met McSwan. He then suffered a head injury in a car accident.
Holy shit!
Right before he decided to take the plunge and start dissolving people.
Right.
So he already had the idea beforehand, but I think it's a pretty big coincidence they had that smack to the head that, you know,
keeps coming up. Put bandages on your children's heads at all times.
Wear a helmet.
They're going to become a murderer.
So all of this was, he told the defence all of this to try and build up the fact that he was insane. And this trial took place on the 18th of July 1949, lasted one day. The jury deliberated for 17 minutes. Because basically he was admitting to everything. There was no dispute. They had the evidence. They had his confession.
But he just wanted to be put in Broadmoor.
Yeah, he just thought either there's nobody that can't get me or get me insane. So 9 doctors had visited him to try and declare him as insane, but only one was willing to take the stand for him, Dr. Yellow Knees. He was
quite... Doctor who?
Yellow Knees.
I thought you said Yellow Knees.
Well, it's not much better, is it? there's all sorts of stuff, like disparaging this doctor, though. Like, he had a tough time after doing this trial. He was quite new.
He was definitely bullied by the doctors.
Yes! And I think he was, like, super excited to, like, be in such a high-profile case that he was like, yeah, I'll do it. I'll say you're insane.
Oh, but then...
Yeah, and then sort of cracked under pressure of the prosecution and was like, oh, well...
I don't know what I'm doing. It's my first day.
He basically admitted that Haig knew what he'd done was wrong, which is like the main, at that time, was the main indicator as to whether someone could be insane or not, is do they know the difference between right and wrong?
Yeah.
And he was like, he knows that it's wrong, but doesn't believe that he is wrong, sort of thing. It was, yes. He sort of fucked up, basically. Yeah. And there's all sorts of, you can go at the National Archives, released loads of letters from John Haig while he was waiting to be hung. And he actually writes letters to Yellow Lees being like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, I know you tried your best, even though you didn't quite do it. And he probably gives him a backhanded compliment, like, while he's waiting.
But you couldn't have done any better. Knowing you and your Yellow Lees, it's the best you could do.
I mean, I don't know if now maybe he would. I mean, they obviously believed at the time that it, a lot of it was pretense. But in a lot of his letters, while he was already sentenced to death, so he didn't have too much to gain from pretending to be insane, he wrote to his girlfriend, he wrote to his parents, he wrote to his doctor, and in most of them he displays this massive superiority thing where he compares himself to Jesus all the time, saying about my perception of humanity is greater than normal people's, just like me and Jesus and Hitler and Napoleon, and like...
Oh, it sounds like a teenager's diary.
It is a little bit like a teenager's diary.
I'm so different to everyone.
Well, he was different because he put people in acid to get rid of them. He was the sludgy bucket killer.
So, the story starts in 1974. And Samuel Cook is a prolific burglar. So he burgles all of the time. That's basically like his living.
Every night.
Known to the police. They see him out and about. They're like, where are you going, Sam Cook?
He's burgling.
Like, going burgling. Just going burgling. Been in jail multiple times.
So a shit one as well.
And he breaks it into a house on Springfield Road in Cambridge. Now, if you aren't from the UK, Cambridge is... well-to-do.
Posho town.
University town. Everyone cycles. Loads of cycle lanes.
I went... My little brother goes to Cambridge University. And I went to pick him up just for this Christmas holidays. And there was a guy who's parked in the campus car park. It's tiny. He was parked across 3 parking spaces. And I was like, knocked on his window like, oh, do you mind pulling into a space so that I can park? And he was like... I'm just the driver. They're going to be out in a minute. I was like,
But you can still park, though.
All right. There's fucking rude, posh, rude people. They have money and they're mean. They saw me in the Fiesta and they were like, I'm not moving for you. And I was like, well, guess what? I'm going to scrape your bumper.
They're not going to be our top C next week. Did you actually scrape his bumper?
I didn't scrape his bumper.
I do wish I could do that. Just bump it. I think we've talked about that before, haven't we?
Oh, I want to run people over so they won't walk in the road.
Both want, like, bumper cars.
You need to learn your lesson!
My dad used to say that he wished he could make little children-shaped robots and then just drive them into the road.
I think we did say
that. Did we talk about that? That's his finest moment. Cook broke into another house on Springfield Road in Cambridge, and he did it many times before, but this time a woman came out of the bathroom and she was wearing just a towel.
As you do. I'd be more impressed if she came out of the bathroom wearing a clown suit. It's what I come out of the bathroom wearing.
And basically, he saw the woman and he didn't waste the opportunity. And he later said, I came to rob and stayed to rape.
Aww.
I mean, in some ways, I find it's more off-putting than murderers, a little bit.
Because he gave it a catchphrase.
But, I mean, we all know if she hadn't been parading around in the comfort of her own home, in a little towel...
How dare she? be in her house wearing what she wants.
The woman was bound and he put a pillowcase over her head, and afterwards he stole £12 from her purse, which even then wasn't a whole lot of money. He wasn't a rapist, but he just took the opportunity.
And that makes you a rapist.
This was the beginning of his sort of career as a rapist. So,
I don't think there's like a club that you join, like, until you've done it three times. I'm not giving you the title of rapist. I think he earned it, like, in the first one.
What I mean is, up until this point, he hadn't been a rapist. He'd been a burglar. Like, he wasn't a known rapist.
I feel like to take that, to see that as being an opportunity, you've definitely done it before.
I mean,
like, you've had sex with a girlfriend when she didn't really want to. Like,
I mean, he had a wife. There's probably some violence.
No way that you're totally down with consent until she comes out in a towel. And that, like, if you see that as an opportunity, you've been raping women without their consent. You've been doing it.
But basically, it's kind of like a career he fell into. Like, you're in one job.
We're making it so official.
In one job, and then someone gives you an opportunity, and you think, oh, I really like this. And then you make that your new thing. So from this point on, he's like, this is what I'm doing.
Okay, he liked it.
He really liked it. So the woman could only give a vague description, as it had been dark. But what she said was, he was kind of stocky, kind of oldish, and 5'4".
See, this is why, I'm sure I was talking about it with you, or something, why I turn all the lights on in the house the whole time that I'm in. Like, people are like, oh, you should save energy. Like, oh, if I'm in the living room, I'll just have the living room light on. No, all the lights are on, because if I'm going to get raped in any one room, it's going to be well lit. I'm going to see exactly who it is.
Yeah, fair play.
It would seem opportunistic if you are tit height, I suppose. Just
I don't think she was.
She's flapping them in my face.
So only 2 weeks later, another young woman was raped in her home in Abbey Road. And this time, Cook had been going through. It wasn't a burglary gone wrong. He was like, I'm going for a rape.
That's like next level raping, though, where you're actually going into their house to do it.
This is why it was so terrifying.
He obviously doesn't think he's getting caught at any point.
No. And it was a university town, so most of these women were not from Cambridge. They were students. So she was in the bath, and the lights went out. So he was turning the lights off ready. Like, he was like, I'm not getting caught.
My plan's failed.
Yeah.
Clap on!
She grabbed a robe and she called for a flatmate. So supposedly there were people around. She heard someone running up the stairs, and then she was pushed to the ground, and then she was pushed into the bedroom, bound, and then raped. And she remembers that she told him that he was hurting her, and he kind of got off on that. So he was getting off on the fact that he was causing harm to women.
He needs to get out of Cambridge. There's clubs in London where you can pay to do this.
So both these rapes had been quite well publicised, and women in the area were beginning to get really scared. But they were expecting him to come into, and it was almost like bedsits or like student housing. So they're expecting him to break in now. So he started changing what he was doing. So on the 11th of November, a woman in Huntington Road Huntingdon Road heard a noise in the back garden, and she opened the door. She didn't hear anyone, but she heard someone sort of scrambling, and she just thought, oh, it's probably a cat. Closed the door, locked it. Heard someone ring the doorbell 20 minutes later. She answered it, and Cook was standing at the door wearing a wig, like a long-haired wig, a knitted scarf, a leather jacket, leather gloves, nothing else.
What?
I mean, that's a fucked up outfit, isn't it?
Okay, so there's a naked man, basically. Naked apart from...
in a wig, a knitted scarf, and a leather jacket. No kegs.
So... oh, my God.
Yep. He launched at her, and she picked...
That's like the village people gone wrong. Like, he was the rejected member of the village people. Like, I'm just sorry, we can't actually swing our dong around.
It's so ridiculous it'd be sort of humorous. A tiny bit taller than me guy in a leather jacket, a woolen scarf, no boxes.
That's stolen Luke's Valentine's Day idea.
So she picked up an iron, she hit him over the head with it, and then she kicked him in the groin. So he left, he went.
Iron to the head.
And the wig came off, she pulled it off. but she threw it after
Was it like a seer wig to like hide his identity?
It was to hide his identity. So he's starting to...
Full on fringe.
Trying to hide who he was. So she threw the wig after him, and then the police came back and looked for the wig, but he'd come back and taken it.
Oh, shit. So, can't leave this behind. How am I going to rape anyone if I don't look fabulous?
Can't get another wig. But the fact that he was starting to disguise himself was scary for people, but it meant that they could sort of... They knew not to just stop people who looked like what they were expecting him to look like. But still, they had no idea who it was. People were freaking out. He's coming to people's doors and stuff, so women were starting to really get anxious. 2 days later, a young music student was practicing in some music rooms, soundproof rooms at the university, but it's sort of like a separate building to the university. The lights went off to someone a minute later, though, and she went out into the corridor, and he grabbed her and held a chloroform pad over her nose. He placed a sack over her head, told her, "I'm not a murderer, I'm a rapist."
Don't panic.
That's comforting.
If you just relax, you might even enjoy it. That's the kind of creepy shit they speak.
He raped her and shed across from the building. So...
Like, he obviously didn't... Yeah, like, he didn't think he was doing a bad thing. He was just like...
I wouldn't murder someone.
I mean, are you having sex with them?
Totally fine raping them.
Ugh.
And, I mean, it really is the nightmare situation, isn't it? It's like a complete stranger coming at you. You can't really see them.
The music practice room would be terrifying. When I used to have to go to the ones in uni, they are just like a tiny little cell, like completely soundproof, yeah. No windows, nothing. The doors lock with like a tiny bit of window.
Yeah.
And you know that no one can hear you because that's the whole point of them. Yeah. I used to be terrified sitting in them on my own, and I didn't even know this story then. Yeah. I would have been a lot more scared.
It is real terror, really terrifying. When I was writing about this, I had the front door unlocked. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm going to die. So women just stopped going out alone. They stopped practicing in music rooms. Men walked women everywhere. Women on the campus were given training on what to do if they were attacked. Whistles sold out at the local shop. Women were just buying like whistles in case they were attacked so they could blow them. So... everyone was like panic mode, as you would be. You
Red
would
just alert.
Be so scared that someone, because nowhere's safe.
No.
And they don't know who on earth it is, and if it was happening so often. So on the 8th of December, and this is such a short space of time, the last one was on the 11th of November. The last one was on the 13th of November. It'd been 2 days after the one before. So 8th of December on Alston Road, a 21-year-old was woken by a torch shining in her eyes. She was in her bed. Someone just came in and started shining a torch in her eyes. Cook threatened her with a knife and placed under their ether soaked pad over her face, forced her into the back garden and raped her on the lawn. The thing that was terrifying about this...
He really doesn't think he's going to get caught. If he took her from the privacy of her house out into the garden where people might see them...
Like, and they'd gone
he
past,
doesn't give one single shit.
They'd gone past the doorway, like the closed door of her housemate whose boyfriend was staying, and they'd heard them go past and they hadn't done anything because they were too scared. So people were there, and he said to her, "The police will never catch me. I have a car and will be in London before they can do anything." She didn't hear a car leaving afterwards. She heard a bike.
I'm going to say everyone cycles in Cambridge. Yeah. You can't get out of Cambridge in a car. It'll take you hours.
Yeah. So he was trying to throw them off. I think he was hoping that she'd say to the police,
"I've got a red car."
Yeah. It's a guy in a car. So now they knew they're looking for a cyclist, which does not fucking narrow it down in Cambridge. Like,
nope.
No chance. The woman also said that the rapist had known her boyfriend's name. God. Which was really freaky.
So do you think he was at the university? Oh, no, because he was a burglar. He wasn't at a university, was he?
No, he was a burglar, so which explains why he was getting into people's houses so easily. So the December the 15th...
Transferable skill set.
Yeah,
next he'll be on The Apprentice.
December 15th, Cook returned to Huntington Road and he woke up a 21-year-old woman with a torch again, tied her up, and this time... got even worse, he slashed her. Shit. So he had been, I mean, obviously rape is very violent, but he hadn't been using weapons up until this point.
Rapists justify it as well by saying, like, because it is sex, they're thinking, oh, it's an enjoyable thing. Like, if they weren't such whatever, like, they could enjoy it if they wanted to. Like, they can, like, there's some nasty fucked up people who justify it like that. But if you're starting to slash people, like, yeah. He is complete control and now, like, sadist, yeah. Isn't it?
And he's, I mean, it's destroying these women's lives. I mean, they're like, being woken up in your bed. I don't...
Being woken up in your bed is horrid. Like, I draw the line there.
That's bad enough. But, I mean, talk about the post-traumatic stress that you would feel from that. I mean, it would just be awful. So, she needed 20 stitches. He'd sort of chased her around the house. And, again, there'd been people in the house.
I think the sickest episode of Benny Hill.
So, they'd been housemates. There was one woman interviewed who was like, yeah, we could hear her running...
What? Like,
running out the house and around the side of the house. And he'd slashed her and then he raped her. And she, again, couldn't say what he looked like. But everyone was so freaked out. People weren't running to people's aid because it was houses full of women. It was like a house with four women.
No, fuck off with that.
So police from all over the country now were being brought in. They were patrolling the streets and they were looking, and they were like plain clothes in uniform as well.
Wearing wigs and leather jackets.
Yeah.
I'm one of you.
All they had to go on was they were taking swabs of semen, which meant police knew the blood group of the rapist. And they also knew that he was infertile. Either he'd had a vasectomy or he had some sort of problem where he... I guess there wasn't any sperm in there. So he was shooting blanks. So they knew that and they knew the blood group. So they thought they could maybe find him that way, and they knew he was 5'4". So basically their plan was they asked all men of 5'4".
They just went round and stopped men in the street if they were 5'4". Like.
And they couldn't enforce... that people give their saliva, but they just asked all men of 5'4" to come in and give a saliva sample.
You would want to... I would want to do it to be ruled out.
That's
though,
what
you?
People were doing. But obviously, the guy who's actually doing it isn't going to come forward,
no.
Is he? Oh, could you optionally come in? Okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to happen. So they tried to narrow it down, but they didn't know that. But they also suspected it was a burglar. Detectives visited... 47-year-old Peter Cook. So he's 47. A skilled burglar. He lived in a caravan with his wife in the village of Hardwick, which was about 5 miles outside of Cambridge. And he worked as a delivery driver for a wine and spirits business. But he was a known burglar. Like...
So drinking and driving.
Yeah.
Perfect. Things to go together.
Drinking and driving. He provided alibis for the crimes. His wife corroborated these. Which is, why the fuck is she doing that?
Because he chloroformed her to sleep.
Oh, probably she thought he's burglarizing.
Oh yeah, that's true.
So she was like, yeah, it's with me. They found loads of pornographic films and magazines at his house, but...
How dare he?
That doesn't prove anything.
He should have stayed home and used them.
Yeah. He declined to give a swab of his saliva.
Guilty!
And he was put under surveillance. And for 3 months, the rape stopped.
No fucking way.
So this is when... he started to get even more sickening. That he's already terrified the whole of Cambridge. They put him under surveillance and you kind of think, job done. No. He's enjoying this attention. He's loving it. Graffiti started to appear saying, the rapist is here.
So he
starts graffitiing around. And obviously, everyone is freaking out because this is actually happening to people that people know. Like, if you think of, like, university, it's quite insular anyway, so everyone's going to know someone who's been raped. And then on 30th of April 1975, a 23-year-old woman was going to bed when she heard a key in the lock of her door.
A key?
Who knows how we got that key? I mean, I put keys under plum pot bricks, whatever.
No, I don't. No. Get one of those key safes where you have to punch in the number. Don't just hide it next to your door.
I'm a bugger for that, if I'm honest. So she had she'd heard about the rapes, obviously.
I think you just casually say that as if it's like a bad habit that you can't stop. Well, I'm a bugger for just leaving my keys around. No, stop doing it.
I think because we have like loads of tradesmen in and out, like, okay. Often we have to leave. I mean, we've given any fucker a key. Like, loads of tradesmen have got my key that I've never got back. I've got a dog.
Mm-hmm.
They have to fight the dog before they get to me.
If you get raped, it's your fault.
When you victim blame him.
No.
So she had got a chain fitted on the door and it held.
Good girl.
She...
That's right, okay, get a chain on the door and I'll feel better. Oh, you can't put the chain on if you're not in, though, can you?
Fuck.
Logic has foiled me again!
She hid in the house with the chain on the door and it stopped. She was too scared to phone the police. Phone the fucking police. Like, that's the first thing you do. Phone the police. And the noise went away, so she was like, fine. Phone the police! Then suddenly, he threw himself at the door, broke the chain. Yeah. If she'd phoned the police, they would have been straight over as well. There's probably a plaincoats policeman down
although
the road.
Although I suppose it's different. Like now, I'd probably have my phone in my hand, in my pocket, and yeah. I could call them from my hiding spot.
I guess
spot.
It's in the hallway.
If it's a landline and you had, she might have had to get up and go to the door where you'd be able to see her. Then you'd be too scared to.
That's true, because he's nearer than the fucking police are. Sorry, language. I'll stop swearing. So he's in the house then. He tied her up and pushed her under the bed covers. And this time, she could see him, he was wearing a leather mask with a zip mouth and two eye holes, made of black leather in the shape of a
mask.
Face, sewn onto a sack. I mean, it's horrifying.
The Oogie Boogie Man.
Yeah, a bit like that. Really, really disgraceful. And he pulled back the zip and said to her, I am the Cambridge rapist. I mean,
so he wanted the attention. He wanted the fame, right?
He was believing his own hype. So that's 13th of April. 6th of May at Pie Terrace, which isn't as delicious as it sounds. It's P-Y-E.
Nope.
He struck in broad daylight. It's the first time that it was day.
Now we've got you.
A student had come home for lunch break. And she was writing notes in the kitchen, turned to see the sink.
Writing notes in the kitchen. Please do the washing up. It's one of your housemates.
Yeah, probably. I mean, that is... There's no way when I was a student, I was coming home at lunch break and doing some more work. He had the same mask on. She turned around. This time he'd written the word rapist on the forehead. I guess it's easier than unzipping every time.
The unzipping was getting a bit... Because maybe you'd have to... If it's a sack as well, you'd have to, like, pull it tight with one hand, then unzip it with the other
hand.
Yeah,
it kind of ruins
like,
the drama.
Yeah, we need to be just rapist on the head. Like, you know straight away.
It's awful. He stabbed her in the stomach before raping her. And again, he mentioned her boyfriend's name. So
he's, like, following these people.
He must...
This before Facebook, like...
Unless he's breaking in prior to check out the house and seeing stuff around. I don't know. He's obviously getting in and out without leaving a trace. Peter Cook, again, had an alibi. So they went and they questioned him straight after this. And colleagues have said that he was there the whole time.
So how do we know it's him?
I think it's said that he probably snuck out so quickly that people, they saw him, didn't see him leave, and then they saw him again. So they just assumed that he hadn't. Left anywhere.
He works as a job delivering, so if he's been there all day, he's not doing his fucking job, is he?
Yeah, that's true.
That's like the opposite of what a delivery person is supposed to be doing.
So, 8th of June, so this is a month later, a 28-year-old Canadian student was asleep in a hostel, and Cook attacked her with a knife, so he threatened her with a knife. Now, two anglers on the river, which is right about 300 yards away, heard her screaming and they started running to find
good,
her.
Good, finally someone's then, heard.
And then they started, and they were obviously shouting as they went. So
poking him with their rods.
Police were...
I'm going to rod you to death.
My friend was on Plenty of Fish years ago and she was so disgusted because someone sent her a message saying, can I dangle my rod in your direction? And I was like, it's Plenty of Fish. She's like, oh yeah! She was just like,
the tamest
what a terrible
message.
Thing to say. I was like, yeah, because it's plenty of... She was like, oh, it might have been
if
all right
if that's
then.
Upsetting you, don't date men.
No.
They're not for you, any of them.
So they'd alerted the police, and basically every police in the area was... Because he ran, the rapist
right.
ran. Every police in the area was basically told to stop anyone. One of the plainclothes officers was on the street, sort of stopping everyone, anyone who walked past.
Stopping anyone who walked past.
Yeah, basically. And a woman started cycling towards him. And so he was like, well, I've been told to stop everyone. So as the woman went past, he told her to stop and they didn't. So he grabbed her hair, but
That's pulled. 70s police officers for you.
Pulled his wig, came off. Right?
And so, that's when he realised she was wearing a leather jacket and no pants.
So, and then, and as he, because that he pulled the wig off and it was like quite a jolt, the cyclist fell over. And then people around, like, people come out of their houses.
Like, made
stuff,
a crowd and blocked it.
Yes, just started grabbing. And it was Peter Cook in a tartan skirt, like full on dressed as a woman. And a woman, like a woman's outfit, and that's how he.
He must have had a feminine face because there's no way he had time to paint up.
I guess if you cycle fast around,
unless his makeup was busted.
But yeah. So that's how they realised he'd been getting away with it because he'd been cycling dressed as a woman.
He had a wig on. That's like Scooby Doo level disguise. Like, yeah. Oh, I've put it on. It couldn't possibly be me.
And they found the mask in his bag. So they found this mask that's literally said rapist on it.
Ooh, his little gimp sack mask.
Yeah. So he went to trial.
And they said rapist on it. Yeah. It wasn't me. Well, this mask says differently.
What's this, Peter? So he went to trial in 1975. He pleaded guilty. How long do you think he got?
For raping loads of women.
Yeah.
I'm going to say he got like 3 years of rape. Let's say he won't have got done for all of them because they'll have said circumstantial evidence. Let's say he got done for 4, so 12 years.
No, they put him in for life.
Oh, did they? Oh, that's good then.
I guess there's a slash in. There's the drug in.
Oh, yes. There was the...
They
no, that's good. I'm going to say normally...
They basically said he's not getting out, he's too fucking dangerous.
Yes, no, that's true, because he didn't give a shit.
He
was just...
So he died...
And he was gearing up, like... The way that he did, like, started with the rape, then to a slash, then to a stab in the stomach. Like, he was going to murder someone eventually if he'd have carried on.
Yeah,
He was like, definitely.
He would have no qualms about it.
Because he was already chloroforming them, so he liked him still. Like, he could have just killed them and then raped them. Like, he obviously didn't give a fuck.
Yeah. So, he lived to 75. He died in prison in 2004. So, he did.
Goodbye. Just want to say thank you to all of our Patreon subscribers for our first month. We have in the drawing room with the lead pipe, Rebecca Pope.
Maggie Dobbs-Schwetz in the conservatory with the knife.
Holly Andrew was in the billiard room with a candlestick.
And Luke was in the hall with a fucking revolver.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.